Good afternoon, how's everyone doing?
Hi.
Baruch Hashem.
Great. Good evening over there. For those who are
in
different time zones.
I can't see you.
Can everyone else see me? I can see me.
Oh, there you go. See you now.
Okay, there I am. Okay. As long as everyone hears me and sees me, then we're in good shape. Okay, so we're going to go back to our stories in Chumash. We're in the middle of the entire description of the encounter between Yaakov and Esav as Yaakov returns back there to Israel. Last time we discussed the Chumash, before Hanukkah, we spoke about Yaakov's interaction with the angel, wrestling with the angel of Esav, and the meaning of that event. Now we're going to move into chapter 33, Perek Lamed Gimel. It's on page 177 if you have your stone Chumash. And that actually, we finally get to the real encounter in the flesh and blood. We spoke of Yaakov preparing for the encounter. We spoke about the encounter with the angel, with the Malach. And now we're going to read today about the actual encounter that ensued between Yaakov and Esav, what exactly happened. So those who are following along inside, we'll look at page 177 in the Stone Chumash. It says, Yaakov raised his eyes and saw, behold, Esav was coming, and with him were 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two handmaids. So we know Yaakov had prepared for this meeting beforehand. He sent gifts to try to appease Esav, try to calm him down, and simply didn't work. Because had it worked, he would have shed the 400 men, and he would have come on his own to greet his brother. The 400 men seemed to indicate that Esav was still ready to fight. Because that's why you're bringing an army with you to greet your brother, if not for the fact that you want to fight against him and his entourage. So despite the fact that Yaakov tried to appease Esav, it did not seem to work, and Esav seems to be approaching, you know, with the intent to fight against Yaakov. Look at the next verse, Pasuk Beis, verse 2. He put the handmaids and their children first, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Yosef last. So Yaakov, you know, had four wives, Rachel, Leah, Bilhah, and Zilpah. Bilhah and Zilpah were the handmaids that he had married. And Yaakov had now, at this point, 11 sons and a daughter that we're aware of. Binyamin was not yet born. So we had the 11 sons, and we had Dinah. So how does Yaakov structure his family? So it's interesting. We spoke about, last time we looked at the story, how Yaakov wanted to divide them into two camps. Ultimately, he didn't do that. Ultimately, they ended up being all together as one to encounter Esav. So commentaries wonder, why didn't Yaakov stick with the separate camps as he intended? I mean, the idea of the separate camps was if Esav comes to attack the northern camp, the southern camp will flee and they'll be safe, or vice versa. But Yaakov seemed to abandon that plan. So why is that? So the Netziv, the Hamik Davar, he says that Yaakov was very encouraged at this point. Until now, Yaakov was very scared because he didn't know what would be. But Yaakov had the dream about the angel. He had that interaction. He had that wrestling match with the angel. And once he saw the results of that wrestling match, that Yaakov came away victorious, Yaakov knew that was a sign from Hashem that Esav's not going to kill my family. I'm still scared. I don't know what's going to happen, but I have much more confidence now in the fact that I had that vision, I had that experience. And now he was sort of emboldened to fight Esav and not have to take too many precautions because he knew that Hashem was with him. So that's what the Netziv explains. The order puts his family in. Chazal uses a famous phrase here, "Acharon, Acharon, Chaviv." You know, the later ones are the more precious ones. Meaning that, understandably, the ones who are in the front lines are the ones more at risk to be attacked, and the ones in the back are more protected. So Yaakov puts, I guess, in the front, the wives he felt the least connection with, which were Bilhah and Zilpah, who were the shvachos, the handmaids. And he put Rachel in the back with Yosef, because Rachel, we know, was Yaakov's, you know, closest wife. So Rachel is the most chaviv to him, the most precious. She's put in the back with Yosef, followed by Leah and her children, and followed in the front with the two shvachos. So they were the ones who are most at risk in this encounter. The that phrase, Achron Achron Chaviv, is used often in many contexts, but it means that, you know, we say, like, you know, we save the best for last. You know, that's an English phrase we would use, but it's the same kind of concept. The last one is the closest one. So many English phrases we have, you do find sourced in Chazal and the Talmud by the sages, and this is one of them, I think. You know, saving the best for last, or, you know, nice guys finish last, or however you want to put it, is part of the idea of Achron Achron Chaviv. Also, the ones in the back do have a chance to flee. You know, if you're in the front, you're the ones who are going to first hit Esav. If you're in the back and you see something happening, you can run away before he gets to you. So the back has that protection. Let's look now at verse 3. Then he, so now they're about to really have this rendezvous with Esav. Then he himself went on ahead of them and bowed earthward seven times until he reached his brother. So Yaakov says, I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to see what happens. And as he approaches Esav, he bows down seven times along the way. He goes first, seemingly to protect his family and to show that he's here humbled. He shows humility. Bowing down to Esav was an act of humility. He's showing Esav, I'm not interested in fighting. I'm willing to submit myself to you. I don't want to cause any problems. And he approaches Esav in a very, very humble and modest way. But also he goes out in the front lines to protect his family just in case there's going to be a battle which ensues. Let's go to verse 4. Verse 4 says, Esav ran towards him, embraced him, fell upon his neck and kissed him. Then they wept. So verse 4 here is actually an amazing pasuk, because Esav runs. Now, why is Esav running is the first question. And then he gives him a hug and a kiss. Now, we were expecting here a fight to the death. You know, he had 400 soldiers along with him, seemingly, and his intent was to fight Yaakov. We know that when Yaakov left two decades back, Esav was intent on killing Yaakov. We know the whole time Esav never really was at ease with Yaakov taking the brachos. And now when he sees Yaakov, he runs to him and he kisses him and gives him a hug and he cries. So there's a lot packed into this verse. You know, what exactly happened to Esav? And I think it's definitely miraculous. I mean, there's certainly a miraculous element of this verse that Esav suddenly had these feelings of brotherly love rather than feelings of hatred and disgust with Yaakov. Let's understand what happened. So for the first and foremost, let's understand the kiss. The Rashi quotes a dispute amongst the sages. Was this kiss sincere or insincere? So Rashi says that according to some opinions, Rashi says that the kiss was done b'chol libo, with Esav's full heart. It was a fully sincere kiss of a brother to a brother. Rav Shimon bar Yochai says it can't be. Rav Shimon bar Yochai says that it wasn't that Esav, I'm sorry, some say that Esav kissed without his full heart. It wasn't b'chol libo. But Rav Shimon bar Yochai says, we know that Esav hates Yaakov. There's a rule. There's a reality. Esav hates Yaakov. So if it was with full sincerity, it was just a momentary, I guess, miraculous or momentary lapse of hatred where he actually embraced Yaakov. So the rabbis were hesitant to say, oh, this kiss shows that Esav's all happy and made up with Yaakov and everything's fine. They're gonna be brothers again and they're going to share yontif together and go on vacation and be good friends. The rabbis are very hesitant to say that. They say it could be it was insincere. It could be it was a momentary feeling of sincerity. But ultimately, Yaakov and Esav did not make up. And it wasn't like Esav now was happy to Yaakov forever. We'll see more in the story, the indications of that. But there does seem to be some idea of sincerity in the word vayivku. It says they cried. If Esav is crying, you know, it's very hard to fake tears. Emotions are very hard to fake. You can fake actions, but not emotions. So if they're crying, both of them, vayivku in plural, that does imply some form of sincerity. But it seems that Esav, at least momentarily, was calmed, was at ease, and did show some signs of brotherhood. So we do see that. The Sforno says that as we always look at the story as an indication of what's going to be in the future, you know, and the way we interact with the Gentiles in Golos, you know, in exile. So Sforno says that there will be times in the future when the Jews are in exile that the Goyim will show us mercy and show us respect. It'll be momentary lapses of that hatred and that will exist. I mean, Esav hates Yaakov. Chazal have this phrase, halacha Esav sonis Yaakov. It's a halacha, meaning it's a reality. It's an absolute that Esav hates Yaakov. And that goes for Esav's children hating Yaakov as well. But even though that's an absolute in history, there will be times where there's some momentary glimpses of love and respect and mercy between the brothers. So the Sforno says that even though most of the time in Golos, we have to deal with anti-Semitism, we have to deal with the attacks from Esav and his children, but there will be those times, such as we see with Yaakov and Esav, that they will embrace us. There might be few and far between, but those times exist. The crying, as we said, represents some form of sincerity and respect. And the Netziv also says, we do find when the Goyim show us respect, we respect them. It goes together. They both cried together, Yaakov and Esav. So when we respect them, they respect us, and they respect us, we respect them. And we do find that there are times of brotherly feelings between us and the Goyim. And he quotes the actual story from the Gemara. The Gemara relates that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, known as Rebbe, you know, the compiler of the Mishnah, the great Nasi and the leader of Klal Yisrael, he was very close friends with one of the Roman emperors, Antoninus. And that friendship wasn't just for political gain. It was a real friendship. They respected one another. They had discussions, meaningful discussions. And this is a symbol of Esav and Yaakov having those times they could get together. You know, the Roman emperors were the descendants, you know, of at least culturally of Esav, spiritually of Esav. But Rebbe and Antoninus had that relationship because there are times where Esav and Yaakov could get along. So it's not a hopeless relationship. It's going to be rare occasions historically, but it could happen. Now, we also find over here that Yaakov, he bowed down to Esav 7 times. So what's the Torah describing? The Torah is describing that maybe Esav was intent on injuring or attacking Yaakov. But when Esav saw Yaakov humbling himself before him, the Sforno says, Nepach libo, Esav's heart was at least temporarily reversed and changed the attitude. And we don't understand sometimes, we have people out there that might have something against us, might be angry with us or hate us. But if we show them some sign of humility or love and respect, it can melt their hearts, you know, on the spot. It really can. There's a very well-known pasuk in Mishle. It says, Kimayim panim al panim, kim leva adam al adam. Like a reflection in water, so does the heart of man to another man. Meaning one of the most tried and tested ways to break tension and to create love amongst those who are actually, you know, having a fight or tense with one another, is if you show love to the other, they show love back. It's like a mirror. Kimayim panim al panim. It's the water, it's the reflection in the water. So Esav very likely could have been intent, I'm going to go attack Yaakov right now. But Yaakov showed Esav this humility and this respect, and that hit Esav in the heart. No, Esav wasn't somebody who was, you know, callous through and through. Yeah, he had emotions. We see Esav crying. We see Esav wanting blessings. We see Esav had something to him. And Yaakov was able to show him that love and respect and engender that back from Esav. So, and that's a quality in life. That's a rule. That's a tactic in life. No, it's very hard because we have to overcome our emotions. Sometimes you're in a fight with somebody, you know, and things are very tense. So our emotions say, you know, be angry, be upset, you know, ignore them, give them the cold shoulder. But sometimes the best method in making up in that fight is to give them a smile and an embrace. And then that melts them down. That breaks the ice. It breaks through the outer shell of being very tense, of the anger, of the fighting, and melts them down, and they want to hug you right back. And I'm sure anyone who's tried that it really works. Kimayim panim al panim kim leva adam al adam. The way that you reflect your face in water, so to the heart of man reflects the other person's heart, and we reflect back emotions to one another. So in some ways, Yaakov was able to, at least from the more natural perspective, by bowing down 7 times to Esav, he was able to hit Esav in the heart, allow Esav to be more at ease, and stop the attack from occurring, and bring out those brotherly feelings from Esav. The Sforno says a fascinating point historically. For those who know the history of the destruction of the second Beis Hamikdash, so the Gemara describes it. It's also brought down in other historic works, that there was a siege in Yerushalayim, and there was a big dispute amongst the leaders in Yerushalayim what to do. The rabbis wanted to go out and make peace with the Romans. There was this group called the Brioni, the zealots, that said, no, we're going to fight to the death. And there was a big dispute, and the Brionim, they destroyed all the provisions they had in the city. So we were forced to encounter the Romans, meaning until that point, we actually had a storehouses full of food, of firewood. The zealots destroyed those storehouses, so we were forced to make a move. We'd all starve to death. But the rabbis wanted to make peace, and the Roman and the zealots wanted to fight. And the Sforno says that had the zealots learned their lesson from Yaakov, they would have gone out to the Romans who had seized the city, put the city under siege, and humbled themselves, just like Yaakov did, and it worked. When Yaakov humbled himself to Esav showed mercy on Yaakov. Had we humbled ourselves before the Romans when they put the siege on Yerushalayim, then they would have been they would have shown mercy on us. So that was the rabbi's idea. But unfortunately, these zealots were a very powerful group, and they wanted to fight, and destruction ensued because of it. But that's a fascinating historical point that Sforno makes, because as we said before, you have to learn from this story how to deal with Esav and his descendants, all the anti-Semites' history. How do you deal with them? And one method is, I mean, you show them respect and love and humility, they will respond back. And then it would have been destroyed. The Jews overall, we don't want to cause fights. Now, I think there's a lesson here in current events, which I don't want to get involved in the current events at the moment. But at least you can learn a lesson from Chumash. You have to just look at Chumash and say, how does it apply to current events, you know, to this day? Rav Volbli, who we quote often, and one of the great Bali Musar of the previous generation, Rav Volbli speaks about this point. And he says that we have to learn as Jews that we don't want to cause any fights. We don't want to incite the Goyim against us. We don't want to be so conspicuous. We should lay low, do our thing, recognize that we are not in control. We're right now in Golos. We're in exile. This country is not our country. We don't make the rules. Thank God the situation we have nowadays in exile is incredibly better than it's been for 2,000 years. You know, you compare modern day America to any other place Jews have been since the destruction of the Second Temple. We're living like kings and queens. It's incredible. But we don't want to be too conspicuous. No, we don't want to rise up against the Goyim in any way. We don't want to protest against what they're doing. There's a phrase that we had in the Parsha last week. When there was the famine happening in the world, and Yosef had food in Mitzrayim. So the brothers still had some food where they were in Canaan, but no one else had food. So Yaakov tells them, Lama Tisro, why are you acting so conspicuously? Lay low. You don't need to show everybody else what's happening. And that's a phrase that we should use often with ourselves. You know, as Jews in exile, we should do our thing, you know, be good people, be peace to our neighbors, do mitzvos, serve God, daven, you know, do what has to be done, but we don't have to be so conspicuous. When you're conspicuous, you're asking for trouble. So people speak about, you know, over the past few months, you know, there have been Jews protesting for this or for that or the other thing. Everyone should ask their own rabbis and mentors what to do. But I think that there's a lot of precedent to say that, no, unless there's specific situations where rabbis feel we should get up and protest, that the role of a Jew in Golos is to lay low. You know, we have to lay low, realize that if we stand up and become too conspicuous, too out there, then we're only asking for trouble. And as long as we can be humble and quiet and respectful of those around us, so then at that point, hopefully they'll leave us alone. We shouldn't rebel, we shouldn't cause fights. But it's something that's been coming up a lot, I think, recently. It's important for us to think about it. It's an important point. Now, is there never a time to protest? No, for sure there is. But it should be very, very limited. And it should be under the guidance of people who are, of rabbis and people who are well-versed in the ways of the government, so that we do it in a way which is not going to bring any sort of enmity or hatred or more disinterest upon us. That's for sure. It goes to the point, you know, a certain gedolim, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, even though there is a custom for Jews to wear their talus out in the street on Shabbos, you go to Israel, most people wear their talus to shul on Shabbos. They walk the street wearing their talus. Rav Yaakov would say, you don't do that in the diaspora. You don't wear your talus in the street. Why do you have to show off your mitzvos? You know, you go to the shul, put on your talus, but to have to walk around like you own the place. You know, we do whatever we want. It's not a good idea for us to do. And there's the same reason why the custom here in America and Chutz La'aretz is to light your Hanukkah candles in the house, not outside. It comes from the same feeling. That, you know, there's grounds halachically right inside the house. No, this is not our place. No, we don't make the rules. No, we don't want to make a scene. So do it inside. For our friends joining us from Eretz Yisrael, we know they light outside in Eretz Yisrael. And that's because, you know, when it's your country, then you can be conspicuous. But when it's not your country, then you lay low. So that's, I think it's an important lesson we get. And what you see from the commentaries here, Yaakov humbled himself before Esav. He didn't want to make a scene. He didn't want to fight back. He decided to just to make peace with him and move on. Now, the rabbis do tell us that when Esav went to kiss Yaakov, there's a medrash that says that really Esav was intending to bite Yaakov. Hashem made a miracle, and Yaakov's neck turned into stone, and he couldn't bite him, so he kissed him instead. So that's a different take on this. I mean, many commentaries are explaining that Yaakov, I mean, Esav actually, he actually kissed him, that he melted his heart. He had become, ready to make peace, and he kissed Yaakov. But others say no. He intended to bite Yaakov. He was going to bite him to death. And Yahashem made this miracle. The neck turned to stone, and Yaakov lived. And he gave him a kiss instead, because what's he supposed to do at that point? That's how the Medrash describes it. So if you take this approach, there's a line that the Ger Rebbe, I think the Chasherim said, which is it's a very sharp line. You know, Esav intended to bite Yaakov with his teeth. He couldn't do that, so instead he bit him with a kiss. So it's a sharp line, and it's an important line, because like we spoke about with Lavan, there's times where the Goyim reach out to us, and it seems to be a very peaceful and merciful interaction. But there could be some malicious intent as well. I can bite you with my teeth, or I can bite you with a kiss. Sometimes friendship with somebody who is wicked is also bad. That causes assimilation. That brings a bad influence into us. That allows them to become a part of our inner circle and corrupt us in that way. So when Esav couldn't bite Yaakov with his teeth, he bit him with a kiss. Friendship with Esav is also dangerous. As we'll see in the coming psukim over here, Esav tries to create somewhat of a bond or friendship with Yaakov, and Yaakov says, I'm not interested. He says it in a very diplomatic way, doesn't want to upset Esav, but Yaakov is not interested in making this friendship. So let's move on, and we'll see how the interaction continues. So look at verse 5. He raised his eyes and saw the women and children. He asked, who are these to you? So Esav saw Yaakov's family, and he asked, who are these people? He answered, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. So he says, these are my children. Doesn't mention the wives. I guess it was obvious these were his wives. Once he says, these are my children, then it's obvious these were their mothers. This is their wife. This is Yaakov's wives. Verse 6. Then the handmaids came forward, they and their children, and they bowed down. Leah too came forward with her children, and they bowed down. And afterwards, Yosef and Rachel came forward and bowed down. So everyone bowed down to Esav, again, showing this humility towards Esav to keep his heart soft, keep him in a good mood, keep his mercy shining, and not to cause any problems. In verse 8, Esav says to Yaakov, and he asked, what did you intend by that whole camp that I met? So we know Yaakov sent like all these people and gifts and sheep and camels and donkeys to Esav before. So Esav wanted to know, like, why'd you send me all those gifts? Like, what did you want from me? He answered, to gain favor in my Lord's eyes. So Yaakov says to Esav, I wanted to gain favor in your eyes. I was trying to make you happy. Esav said, I have plenty. My brother, let what you have remain yours. So Esav was refusing the gift. So Yaakov intended to send Esav all these gifts, and Esav refused them. So we have to understand, why did Esav refuse the gifts? And we'll see in verse 11. Let's read 10 and 11, then we'll go back. Look at verse 10. But Yaakov said, no, I beg of you, if I have now found favor in your eyes, then accept my tribute from me. And as much as I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of a divine being, and you are appeased by me, please accept my gift, which was brought to you. In as much as God has been gracious to me, in as much as I have everything, he urged him and he accepted. So Esav first hesitated to take the gift. Yaakov kept on trying to charm Esav. And Yaakov pressured Esav to accept the gift. And he did. He accepted the gift at the end. So why did Esav not want the gift? And why did Yaakov pressure him to accept the gift? I mean, it's an important question. So the Sforno says, he quotes from another verse that we have elsewhere in the Torah. Keshochad ya'aver eni chachamim. We know that bribery is forbidden. And especially to judges. Why? Because it's going to blind their eyes. It's going to make them not see the truth when it comes to judging a court case. When you give somebody a gift, so that incurs favor from them. Whether they intend to show you favor, don't intend to show you favor, they intend to even if they're trying to be honest and genuine, whenever someone gives something to you, you feel indebted to them, and then you're going to want to help them out and go out of your way to do what they say. So Yaakov wanted to give Esav the gift because Yaakov wanted Esav to feel a bit indebted to Yaakov. He said, if Esav accepts all these gifts from me, he's going to feel, in the long term, more indebted to me because he accepted from me camels and donkeys and sheep and all these things I sent him. Esav may recognize this. And Esav said, well, I don't want to be indebted to Yaakov. If I take a gift from him, then I owe him something. And I don't want to Yaakov anything. So he didn't want to feel this sense of being indebted to Yaakov, this bond. But Yaakov said, no, I want you to take it. He urged him. I guess Esav couldn't turn down the money at the end. And Esav took the gift, which means that Esav did walk away feeling a little bit more of this bond or this being indebted, feeling his little more Yaakov's hands. And Yaakov felt that that was important for his safety. He probably felt it's important for the future that Esav feels a little bit of that warmth or that indebtedness towards me, so that if anything ever comes up, you know, he's going to be a little bit more inclined in my favor. So that seems to be the give and take between Yaakov and Esav. And even though in our lives, if someone gives us a gift and the intentions are totally pure, you know, they're not trying to get anything out of us, you feel a connection towards them. You feel you want to do something for them. So they say, no, it's not necessary. It's a gift. Don't worry about it. But when someone does you a favor or gives you a gift, it's natural to feel that you want to respond back in some way. It's natural to feel that you want to somehow show them that you appreciate it. You want to do something back for them. Now, Rav Dessler says that when somebody is a giver, so when you receive a gift, you really want to give something back. Why? Because if you just receive something and don't give, you're a receiver. You're a taker. You're not a giver. A giver wants to give. So we try to give back payment. The person says, no, it's ridiculous. It's a gift. You try to give back favors. They say, no, it's not necessary. I did this for you because I care about you. I want you to take a gift from me. So the best you could do is you say thank you and show your appreciation. But even that's a form of payment. When you give back a thank you, that itself is a payment to a person. And that's why we feel it's so important to say thank you, because that's us being givers, because I don't want to receive something for free. So at least the gratitude is something which I'm going to give back to the person who gave it to me. So Esav also, Yaakov said, please take this from me, because I want you to feel that towards me. Yaakov wanted that because that'll give a little bit of leverage over Esav in the future. And Esav took it at the end. He accepted it. There are two phrases here which are very important to focus on, which Rashi points out, but it gives you a whole different glimpse of the world of Yaakov and the world of Esav. In Pasuk Tes, in verse 9, Esav says the words, Yesh li rav, I have a lot. In Pasuk Giralef, verse 11, Yaakov says the words, Yesh li kol, I have everything. And the rabbis contrast these two phrases. If I'm trying to say, I have what I need, don't give me any gifts. So I can say it in two ways. I can say, I already have tons of things, or I can say, I have everything I need. So they sound like they're similar phrases, but they're actually worlds apart. And I think there's two ways in which we can understand these phrases, why they're worlds apart. Number one, when I say Yesh li rav, I have a lot. What I'm saying is I can always have more. The more I have, the better. I could always have more, and I have a lot right now. It's somewhat of a somebody who's thirsty for more and more wealth will say, I have lots and lots, but you know, there's always room for more. I could always have more money and more houses and more cars and more possessions and no problem. But then there's also the idea of Yesh li kol, which means I have everything I need. And this speaks really, I think, to two points. One point is, you know, there's the famous words in Pirkei Avos, Ezu Asher, who's truly wealthy? Hasmeh b'chelko, that person is happy with their lot. If you say Yesh li rav, you're showing I'm not happy with my lot because I want more. I'm not complete. I'm not happy with what I have. I can always use more and more things. So the rabbis tell us, is that someone who's truly wealthy? Well, it's important to understand wealth is not a function of a person's bank account. Wealth is a function of your attitude. Someone can be very poor in terms of their income, but if they're happy with their lot, that's an usher, they're wealthy. And someone can be tremendously wealthy in terms of their income, but if they feel needy, then they're poor. Being usher ani, being wealthy or being poor, are totally an attitude. It's not a matter of, you know, of assets or income. It's a matter of attitude. So Yaakov's attitude was, I have everything I need. Yaakov felt wealthy. I have kol. I have all I need. I'm happy with my lot. I don't need anything else. Esav may have been very wealthy than Yaakov. I don't know how much money Esav had. He seemed to be a very wealthy man. But Esav felt needy. He says, I have a lot, but I don't have everything. I could use more. I have other things I can use. So that's one take on this, which is a big difference from Yaakov and Esav. Furthermore, we have to understand that when I say Yesh li kol, it's saying there's an element of fulfillment or a completeness in my life. And if I say Yesh li rav, it means that there's something something additional is going to make me happier. So let me explain that. Let's say you have, we're all looking at computers right now. So we say a computer is a good thing because it works. We can, you know, we can do Zoom, we can go on the internet, and we can pay our bills, and we can do everything on computers. So I say, well, the computer inside of it has, I don't know, 20 wires. So let's add another 10 wires in. If the computer's got 20 wires, then 30 wires must be even better. Now, the truth is you add in 10 more wires, you can blow the computer. It won't work. It'll malfunction because the computer is complete. It's a complete item, and more doesn't make it any better when it's complete. So the attitude in life has to be, well, more is not always better. If I add extra wires that aren't needed to my computer, let's say I have a house. I say, you know, my house is great. It has in it, you know, this much wood in the walls. So I'm going to throw more wood in the walls because why not? The answer is, well, if you're not expanding outwards, you're just going to have things, it's going to expand inwards. It's going to be smaller and the wood's getting in your way because it has what it needs, right? The house is complete. If you add in more wood into the walls, it's just going to cause the house to enclose in on you unless you make an expansion or something. But the attitude of Esav, of Yishli Rav, is not recognizing the fact there's an idea of Shlemus. There's an idea of being a complete unit, which makes person what they are. And this is what Hashem gives you what you need for life. If you say Yishli Kol, you're saying, I have what I need. My life is complete. Giving more to me is not going necessarily going to help me. And that's something that we struggle with. And we think, well, if I have more money, more possessions, that's going to make me better off in some way. The answer is, well, maybe yes, maybe no. Depends. If you're already complete what you have, so then it's not going to help you anymore. But if you're incomplete, then maybe it'll help you. But the attitude of Yishli Rav is not always a positive attitude. I see that we have a hand raised. I don't know how to, there you go. Lower hand and unmute. Where'd you go?
Hi. Okay, can you hear me or am I still muted? So I have a question about that. Because isn't there a saying that no man dies without, all men die with more than half of what they want still unfulfilled? So, yeah. Right? So if that's part of the human condition, then like it's hard to say what you're saying here. In other words, we have shlemut, but I understand that the concept of being satisfied with what we have and the idea of ezehu hashir, hasmech b'chalko, but not to strive for more. I wonder if there's a negative side to that, or that it's not even part of the human condition that no one dies except with more than half of their their desires unfulfilled.
Right.
Does that make
sense? It's a good question. You're talking the phrase in ramais v'chatzit havasu biyado. It says a person does not die with even half of their taiva, their desires in their hands.
Right. Yeah.
That's the phrase. Mm-hmm. So I think we are created in a world where we always do want more. And I think you're right. That's part of the human condition. But I think the idea of Yaakov Yishli Kol is trying to show us what the goal is. I mean, we should be always working towards the fact of Samech Mechelko. Are we going to fully get there? It's a very hard thing to get to because we live in a material world where more does seem better. So it's a struggle we're all going to deal with. The terminology used in that, what you're quoting, is Taiva Subyado. Taiva usually means physical pleasures. So if a person's life is focused on physical pleasures, the point is that they're not going to ever feel fulfilled. But if you say my life is focused on something else, you could feel fulfilled. And I think it's a matter of what you're focusing on. Because the physical pleasures will never be fulfilled. And that's a fact. And that's part of our condition. But if we say, but that's not how I define myself, I define myself through spiritual accomplishment, then you could feel fulfilled. I think that is possible. But it's an interesting question, the contrast to this. Very interesting. So let's finish the story. So move on to verse 12. And he said, travel on, let us go. I'll proceed alongside you. So this now is Yaakov speaking to Esav. I'm sorry, Esav to Yaakov. And Esav tells Yaakov, let's go together. Let's travel on. And we'll travel together. We'll be good friends. We'll make some sort of agreement together. We'll bond. And we'll travel together as brothers. Let's join forces. That's what Esav tells Yaakov. Now, if we view Esav as Esav of Russia, as a wicked person, probably his intent here is to try to infiltrate and corrupt Yaakov in some way. The same way we discussed with Lavan a few weeks back, how Lavan wanted to make an agreement with Yaakov, and that was the only order to infiltrate and corrupt Yaakov. So if we were to keep Esav viewed in that same light, which seems to be who Esav was, even though there might be momentary glimpses of mercy and brotherhood, ultimately Yaakov is very suspicious of this. Yaakov doesn't want it. So in verse 13, Yaakov starts giving excuses as why he doesn't want to travel with Esav. I mean, even if Esav may have been momentarily sincere, You can't trust him. Yaakov says, not going to be a good idea for me to bond with Esav this way because ultimately I don't know where it's going to go. So in verse 13, Yaakov tells him, he says to him, my Lord knows the children are tender and the nursing flocks and cattle are upon me. If they'll be driven hard for a single day, then all the flocks will die. He says, I'm going to be moving much slower than you. I have kids. I have a lot of flocks. I have a lot of baby animals and I can't push them too hard. I'm going to slow you down. In verse 14, he says, let my Lord go ahead of his servant. I'll make my way at my slow pace according to the gate of the drove before me and the gate of the children until I come to my Lord at Seir. So Yaakov says, you go ahead. I'll go my own pace. And eventually I'll meet up with you. That's what he tells him. So Yaakov gives excuses. He does not want to connect the Esav in this way. There's a phrase that the rabbis use. It's a cute phrase about bees. They say, lo mi ukzo, lo mi duvsho. I don't want its sting, I don't want its honey. But sometimes in life, there's people that we don't want their sting or their honey. And it's not worth it. So same thing with Esav. I don't want his sting, I don't want his honey. Lo mi ukzo, lo mi duvsho. I don't want it. The Ramban says here that Yaakov did not want it all to bond with Esav. He didn't want it. He was scared of it. He didn't think it was a good idea. So in verse 14, he tells him, I'll go my own pace. You go ahead and I'll catch up. So the rabbis say, well, Yaakov never caught up. Yaakov says, I'll come to my Lord at Seir, but Yaakov doesn't go to Seir. So the question is, was Yaakov is lying? I'll never catch up. You know, what was Yaakov's intention? So the rabbis tell us that Yaakov is making a prediction for the days of Mashiach. Because it says in the book of Avadja, that the Moshiim, the saviors, will go up Har Sion, the mountain of Zion, and they will judge the mountain of Esav, meaning that we will eventually go to Esav's mountain in the future, and we will judge Esav, it says in the Pasuk. So Yaakov is saying, yeah, not now, but later, later meaning when Mashiach comes, we'll meet up again, and then we'll make sure things are in the right format. So that's what the rabbis say about this verse. But Yaakov, again, doesn't want to bond with Esav, gives excuses, sends him ahead, and says, I'll go my own pace, and then I'll meet you in the future. Yaakov's word, that he said, the Hebrew word here is le'iti, at my own slow pace. And many rabbis point out that this is a very important term for us practically, because this is the method of how a Jew grows in the service of Hashem. We can't expect to make, you know, these humongous leaps, you know, in one shot. You know, right now I'm struggling with X and I'm going to conquer it and I'm going to become so great. I'm going to be the greatest human being. I'm going to fix all my bad midos. I'm going to be perfect in my davening and in my mitzvos. That's not something that we can do. We have to work slowly and gradually grow. And that's an important lesson for us. Yaakov says, I can only travel at my own slow pace. I can't push ahead. If you push ahead, then it's counterproductive. If I push ahead, then I'm going to kill my baby animals. I'm going to endanger my children. So it's a lesson for us. How do you push ahead in serving Hashem? You push ahead at your own slow pace. You're always pushing ahead, though. The idea is you're always growing. You're always pushing ahead. But if you push yourself too hard, too fast, it'll backfire. And the different commentaries bring out from here that this is sort of a model of that. Also, have to realize, some point out, that, you know, we said that Yaakov is going to greet Esav on Mount Seir in times of Mashiach. So there have been times or movements over history that have wanted to sort of like push Mashiach to come faster. And some commentaries say, you know, from this verse, you see that we have to go at a gradual pace. We have to be patient. You know, we'll greet Esav at our seer. We'll get there. Mashiach will come. We'll get to Esav. But it says here, le'iti, it'll be at a slow pace. You know, we have to do our job here in this world before Hashem brings Mashiach. And once he does, so then we'll meet up with Esav once again. But that's something which it's a lesson for us. We have to be patient. You know, serving God is a lifetime. It's a lifetime job, lifetime mission. You know, you can't change everything in a day. You have to look at it over the course of an entire lifetime. And bringing Mashiach is a result of history. You also can't look at that as something that we can do in a day. We do our job day in and day out to be the best Jews we can be, be the best people we can be. And Hashem will bring Mashiach at the right time. But everything has to be done le'it at the right time, at a slow pace, because that's how we function. We can't function otherwise. So let's look at verse 15. It says, then Esav said, let me assign to you some of the people who are with me. So Esav tries again. He's like, okay, I won't go with you, Yaakov, but I'm going to send some representatives with you because I want to give you, you know, some people who are going to be part of your camp who are my people, to show our connection, to show our bond. They'll help you out. I'll show my love that way. So again, Yaakov is suspicious of this. He thinks that Esav wants to sort of infiltrate into Yaakov's camp. So he says, Yaakov responds, into what purpose? Let me just have favor in my Lord's eyes. He says, I don't need it. Just be happy with me and leave me alone. That's what he tells him. So the Ramban says here as well that we look at this whole story as a model of how to deal with the Gentile nations, Gentile governments. The rabbis used to learn this story before approaching the Roman nobles for requests. And one idea here is that we don't make a partnership. We don't want to join hands with them. We can work together on certain projects, but to make a permanent partnership with the non-Jewish government never worked out in our favor. They tried it many times historically, and we know that often that just backfired against us. So they say, we're going to make a bond with you. We're going to put of our people into your institutions. We're going to make some official connection. There, the lesson should be, no, we don't want to make any official connection. Can we work together on projects, on certain goals? For sure. And we should. But we have to be very careful not to create that partnership, which will often backfire. It happens with, you know, in the times, every single time the Jews have invited the non-Jewish government into their affairs historically, it always turned out bad. That's what happened before the destruction of the Second Temple. The Romans entered Eretz Yisrael, not because they conquered it, but because the Jews invited them in. Once that happened, it wreaked havoc amongst the Jews. And it happened again and again that way. You have to be very, very careful. Let's look at the final, and the end of the story, verse 16. So Esav started back that day on his way towards Seir. But Yaakov journeyed to Sukkos and built himself a house. And for his livestock, he made shelters. He therefore called the name of the place Sukkos. So it says that Esav went back on his way to Seir. So the Rav Hirsch says this word Lidarko, on his way to Seir, it has a double meaning. It doesn't just mean he physically went back on the path. It means that Esav remained in his own evil ways. I mean, you might look at this story and say, well, Esav's changed. Look, Esav made peace with Yaakov. He did tshuva. Now he's going, no, everything is better. The answer is no. This was a temporary, for whatever reason, miraculously or emotionally, there was a temporary lapse, that hatred. And Esav did show some sort of respect or love towards Yaakov in one way or the other. But he went back with the dark. He went back on his old ways. He didn't change even after this encounter. The peaceful encounter was miraculous. It was temporary, but it ended. And from here on out, Rav Hirsch says that Esav and Yaakov diverge and their lives take a totally different path and different meanings. And historically, never came back together again after this meeting. Again, the prophet says they'll come back together in one way or the other. Mashiach comes as we approach Har Esav and judge them. But this parting of ways became permanent. And Yaakov and Esav diverged on different paths, as Rivka herself knew when her sons were born. Way back in the beginning of Parshas Toldos, when Rivka was pregnant and the two babies were fighting in the womb, and she was told by the prophet that you have two different nations who are going to diverge on totally different paths, that prophecy said that they're never going to get along. There may be temporary times of respect and love, but it's never going to be permanent. So the meeting was miraculous. There were some overtures of brotherhood that were here, but Yaakov remained suspicious, rightfully so. And historically, we've seen this as well. Historically, we've seen that there have been these momentary lapses of the anti-Semitism where things were good, but always broke out again. And we have to always be respectful, never confrontational, never violent, but always suspicious whenever these types of situations come up. I mean, that's the lesson of the story. Okay. Any questions? Okay. Everyone should have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Shavuot Tov.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.